I'm Rob Hirschfeld, CEO and co-founder of Rakuten and your host for the Cloud 23 podcast. In this episode, we diverge from our planned agenda and take on the structural failure of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, Maryland, which incidentally is my hometown. And we discuss what happened with the bridge, so some current events, but then we also talk about it more broadly. How to prevent these types of failures, what things we can look at, the lessons learned from here. And I think there's some really interesting components to take away in this broader conversation. We even get into AI, data sharing, digital twins. We spend actually a fair bit of time on digital twins. So if you're really interested in thinking more deeply about how you can apply this type of catastrophic failure, lessons from it, into your life and your professional career, this will be a great episode for you. Oh, and we are going to be spinning up our next book in the Book Club series, so stay tuned for details about that, and I hope you will choose to read it and join us. Good morning. Sorry I was away last week.
No worries. Are you okay? Is everybody okay?
Everybody's fine. I've been traveling like a demon is my challenge.
Yeah, no, I meant with the bridge. Should I send you a dinghy?
A rowboat. Everybody's we're all fine.
Okay.
And they happily managed to keep all the commuters off the bridge for the collapse. I mean, the stars aligned in a bad way for that boat to hit it in just the wrong spot. But there were a lot of things that conspired to keep the human impact pretty limited. That was, oh my God, stunning. We live close enough into the city that it's really not an impact for us. That bridge is usually mostly used for people who are avoiding Baltimore. it's the bypass.
It's rather bypass, exactly.
Yeah, but it will drive a lot of extra traffic into the beltway. But I'm inside the beltway, so it's for us it's pretty minimal. Except being, it's a beautiful bridge. That's a loss from that. And then all of Baltimore sort of feels like a gut punch, something broke and a piece of art that you had that broke, almost. So
sad.
It's sad. It's going to be, there's a lot of interesting lessons learned from it. So, infrastructure resilience, as an engineer watching the span come apart, was like, oh, okay, there's a whole engineering class in that 30 second video.
I hadn't looked at it until this morning and just, watched that thing come down in the course of seconds. And just, I was amazed.
Yeah, the thing that I don't find being covered well is frustrating to me is, from my analysis of it, it was a very unlucky strike. I'm going to switch to I haven't screen shared with my tablet for a long time. Let me see if I can do it, because I've been trying to explain this with words and I'm not doing a very good job with words doing it. Let's see. Oh, here it is. Cool. All right. This looks like the right thing. Huh. All right. You should be able to see my tablet. That looks right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Is it showing both parts of my tablet? That's funny. Okay. All right. Just one screen?
No. Yes, it's one screen.
Okay.
Well, it's one overlaid on top of the other. Yes.
That's fine. Yeah, that's what I didn't realize it was going to look up, show up as two windows. So here's the piling. This is the piling, that critical piling that the boat was on.
Right.
And so I'm going to show two views, a planned view and a forward view. And in that, on that piling, it had a big triangular concrete strut holding up the bridge, and the water's right here.
Right.
And so what with the boat, they keep showing the boat as like this big, you know, like classic boat shape like this, which is true, but that's not actually how container ships are built.
Right.
They actually have a long nose, and so they're sort of like this,
same long nose that got that boat in trouble in the Suez Canal.
But the thing that's at the waterline, but outside of the waterline, to make the cargo capacity bigger, the deck actually goes out like this.
Right.
So there's this overhang section. The reason that's important is the nose of the boat is right here. And then it overhung like this.
Right.
And so what happened is as the boat came into this section, that this overhang, instead of being like a normal boat would have been, old style boat would have been deflected. But if you watch some of these videos, what you'll see is that the deck structure is actually overhanging into this critical
section. And that's what took out the pylon.
Correct. It was this overhang right here that is where it just destroyed the pilings. But they're not presenting that the way, you know, maybe it's too complex of an analysis, but
I have a question. How old is that bridge?
70. It was completed in 77, so it was designed in the 60s. Okay. Before container ships were a thing.
Yeah. So that was where I was leading, that this sounds like a design of the bridge was safe for ship designs at the time.
Yeah.
Tech Dead happened.
Tech Dead.
This carrier was 934 feet long. What they're saying, the equivalent of three football fields. But to your point, Rob, that overhang, as I understand it as well, doesn't just start at the front. It goes through the entire length till it starts to taper a little bit in the back. And so what I don't understand is why they're using divers and not underwater robots to start clearing a channel faster of the kinds of debris that's in there to get it done. I mean, certainly they'll use some submersibles, but I was talking to somebody very early this morning in Europe, and their company makes submersibles that are used to do oil rig creation. Right. So they prefabricate the pylons and then they dump them into the ocean and then they affix them. But they actually have robotics that they use to do a lot of the underwater welding and whatever, so that humans aren't put at risk. Yeah. And I didn't hear any of that from the alleged Army Corps of Engineers as they're going to try and take this thing, you know, down in pieces or move pieces of it. And why wouldn't they also create a dam on either side of where, disaster is? Oh,
that's an interesting idea.
To start using, like, you know, these gigantic boom cranes that they have when they do build oil rigs in the ocean, like they used on Horizon.
One of the biggest cranes in the world is actually stationed nearby. So I'm sure they'll bring it in. I think there's two components. Well, one is just availability of the materials, to ensure it's flowing in. There's, up until today, they were treating it as a rescue/human remains recovery. And so I think they're being a little careful. And it's only 50 feet deep. So from putting people in the water, it's not a
particular, you know, 50 feet's not a very hard dive. But there's wreckage down there. So I would expect that the robots, they'd be using robots pretty aggressively.
There's also apparently some of the material in the containers that were breached.
Yeah.
That broke open is fairly nasty hazardous stuff. Yeah. So that would be another reason to do robotics.
Such a mess.
I mean, when we were speaking about this morning, we had literally kind of created this notion of like a dam on either side so that they could get the cranes close enough to start pulling the stuff out without using as few humans as possible to try and do that. And I'm sure that they're still going to be very, very careful with human remains or looking for people and whatever, but it just... I mean, this is years worth of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. And they need to reopen a channel through that wreckage as pretty fast quickly as they can. Yeah.
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 So that'll be a thing. Happily they found two, there were six workers unaccounted for. They found two in a car. I'm probably trying to evacuate, and the other ones, who knows what'll happen.
I can't believe one guy actually was able to swim away. One of the survivors. I mean, 185-foot drop. That's unbelievable.
It's really great. And during that, it's a question of whether how much warning they had to. But they don't know what to hope for anymore. It's all
be
interesting to hear what the survivors have to say about it. And I'm just stunned that they were, they had enough warning and foresight to get the traffic off the bridge. So, right. I mean, I'm sure they have protocols for it, but that's.
Sure. But it almost seems from the videos that the warnings were foresighted warnings because you see the lights go off on the ship. You see the smoke billow. You see it start to move in one direction, and then it's it's just floating by the current. You know, like how long an interval was it between the lights first going off, the mayday call, and whatever for them to notify people to stop the traffic?
I think they had it most like 3 minutes. It was not long. Yeah, the power failure was very badly timed. Fortunately for that, but it's such a big boat. It'll be interesting to see if they think fendering that pylon would have made a difference. That's one of the things that's changed. To Klaus's point about technical debt is modern bridges have much more aggressive fendering.
Well, they do couple of things. The Bay Bridge, when they rebuilt the Bay Bridge, the pylons are tapered as opposed to the triangulars. There are a couple reasons for that, but also the footings that they're on are much broader, much bigger for exactly this reason. Fend off, as much as possible the boats from actually taking out the pylon.
Yeah.
I tell you, if you ever want to have I used to think that the Bay Bridge was a hairy experience driving over. And then I went on then I drove over the bridge between New Brunswick and PEI, Prince Edward Island. That's a bridge that extends out into the sea. Holy macaroni is all I can tell you. That is a hair-raising experience. It is because no matter how good the weather is, it sways. It sways. Life and you're driving and it's very narrow. Like you think if you're going to go to the expense and time of building a bridge, like build it four lanes instead of two, like the add-on is going to be triple the cost, but you drive, you literally drive out like quite a distance above and over the ocean. And that's where the Atlantic meets the North Sea.
Oh my goodness, rough water.
very rough water, very, very rough water. Like you can literally go to, there's a place in Prince Edward Island, which is a beautiful little place to visit, by the way. But there's a thing called Singing Sands Beach, which is, it's called that because when you walk on the sand, it's so much silica that it literally sings when you're walking on it. But I was there on July 1st, 1 year, height of the summer. It was 46 degrees in the Atlantic when you put your feet in. So, you know, I ventured up to my ankles before I said, okay, I can say I went into the North Sea where, you know, the North Sea meets the North Atlantic.
Yeah.
Check off the box. But but that bridge is really, really hairy. So now to me, the Bay Bridge, as unsettling as it may be, is nothing in comparison.
No, that's crazy. I think everybody's going to look at bridges a little bit more. I'm going to ask this as a question. Does this undermine your confidence in bridges?
No. Like it's not like the front fell off the bridge or a door came out of it.
Yeah.
Like with the airplanes.
Yeah.
Ouch.
That's true.
I don't know if it undermines my view of bridges as much as, and I don't mean this to be disrespectful in any way, shape, or form. It really underscores the reason that you guys have a huge infrastructure bill that went through your Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me that hindsight is 2020, just talk about fendering. But if they had had the budget, would they have done more in the way of resecuring or restructuring the supports of that bridge, knowing how much traffic goes into that harbor?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I, you're right. I think that there's actually an interesting hollowing out of the engineering core for the infrastructure teams, right? One of the, I've heard this, when it's really fascinating thought. Somebody I heard an analysis of why European infrastructure projects are so much cheaper and faster than American infrastructure, specifically US infrastructure projects. Mm-hmm. And what it is that we contract out almost every component, including the engineering expertise, and the government takes on a real, like an oversight role, but they don't maintain the engineering expertise. And so our departments, government departments, don't have the engineering expertise to sort of supervise these bridges or supervise the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And
our infrastructure shows that. And so, in this country in particular, this kind of regulation is written in blood. Doesn't get put in place until you have, you know, an Exxon Valdez or a bridge issue.
It happens in IT as well. Like you ask any SRE and they're well familiar with the with the conversation of like nothing's breaking. Why am I paying you? Versus everything is breaking. Why am I paying you?
That is a very sad truth for this. And it is, there is an interesting lesson on that bridge was structurally amazing, right? In that, like even watching the failure, you can see just how well engineered the structure was, because it really held form even during that event, right? It failed in exactly the way that it should have failed. And it was very rigid, like the structural components stayed rigid. But there was structural problems in the fact that the bridge was, you know, 50 something years old and hadn't been, you know, to your point, the environment around the bridge hadn't reevaluated what had been going on around it.
Well,
material stress.
Yeah. To go to the IT analogy also, operationally, the port of Baltimore used to permit the tugs to take these boats all the way out past the bridge.
Okay.
For budgetary reasons, the tugs just get it out of the immediate docking area and on their way, so, and turn around and go back because
they got such a
backlog. Think about it. Had there been tugs,
it would have made all the difference. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
There would have been redundancies at least.
Precisely. And that's the same in every American port.
What I find interesting, though, is if you look at companies like Maersk in Europe and what they're doing with autonomous cargo transport on the water.
Are you talking about Maersk, the Danish?
Maersk, yes. Yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm. If you look at them, and I think it's two or three others, they have a consortium that's involved in testing now these huge cargo ships that are absolutely autonomously driven and robotically controlled. Hmm. And to me, it seems like you could do the same thing with the tugs to reduce the cost. To be able to take ships in and out. They're trying to do that in Montreal now, because Montreal is a huge port. Montreal and Vancouver are the two biggest ports, right? So they're trying to do it in Montreal. They have some of it happening in Vancouver, but they're trying to automate the whole process of the ships docking or exiting the port, not only to do a faster turn, but to do a more environmentally friendly kind of run, and also to make sure that they can prevent as many accidents as possible. Not that there are that many, but they're saying that if they can bring the large containers autonomously across the world, that smaller vessels and guidance systems should be able to bring them into port much faster, much more cheaply, and much more easily. And it's part and parcel in their whole digital twin thing, which they do for cargo now, how they automate taking all the containers off the boat and moving them around in ways that are so much quicker than it usually takes, according to what I read, 11 days for a container to go from being offloaded from the ship to being cleared out of the port. And they can do it now in under 2. And sometimes in under 24 hours, because they've built this whole automated elevator type system, a very neat design. That plays like, what was it, Tetris with the containers. And it's actually built on the same game theory as Tetris.
So there's more caching, like they actually have some intermediate caching and like on the crane itself so they can stack.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really simple. Yeah, because now you're not dealing with a person. You're like, okay, I can put some algorithms in there.
Yeah.
Right.
That's cool.
The idea of
autonomous tugs, you know, improving the result. I need to recalibrate how I feel about autonomous systems handling emergency procedures. In the case we're talking about, how would an autonomous tugboat have handled the power outage? I guess there'd be protocol for a ship power outage. You would have said, all right, this is actually within, you know, light speed distance of the shore, and you would have had, you know, probably better, faster telemetry. You would have had a remote pilot on hand, and then you have a remote pilot for, you know, six or seven. That makes sense. I mean, the thing that I always think about with drones that is important, and that made actually drones, like, because we had quadcopters before they became drones, and quadcopters are pretty hard to pilot, but drones are easy because we have all of this navigation. And so one of the things that's important with drones is, you know, when they don't know what to do, they have soft landing and they have hold in place, right, and recover modes. Mm-hmm. And an autonomous tug system or autonomous ship system, you'd want to have a this, you know, I'm in an uncertain spot, hold, stall, stop type of thing, I would assume. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would assume that an autonomous tug, because it has real-time telemetry and geospatial coordinates and everything else, it would be able to account in real time for the current just changed from left to right, you're in a neap tide versus a rip tide, all of that kind of information, air, you know, air information, all the metrology that you would need to be able to say, the minute the lights flicker, start lowering the anchors, but don't drop them, right? Because you can do that.
Just go to the water line, but don't do a full release.
Go to the water line, be prepared to drop, be prepared to, you know, pivot the other direction, be prepared to do whatever you need to
You could also be launching autonomous tugs and, you know, retasking.
Sure.
Right.
Exactly.
This didn't have enough. It's an interesting thing to think, though, that, you know, we could be having additional engagement in these pieces.
So yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Tim. Welcome. Good to see you.
Long time to see. You know, what is it? Long time listener, first time caller. doesn't quite apply. Welcome. It's been a long time. Thanks for keeping this going. My gosh.
We've been having fun. We're off the agenda at the moment because we're talking about the lessons learned from the Key Bridge disaster, and we've transitioned into tech equivalency and AI and automation and how we could use alternate thinking in this and some lessons learned to improve outcomes in the future. So
it's funny how everyone all of a sudden becomes a structural engineer and expert and a piloting expert and a maritime expert when these things happen. Just fascinating.
Definitely, doing a little couch quarterbacking.
Yeah. That wheelchair quarterbacking.
I will tell you that I do have an engineering degree to do enough structural analysis to be dangerous. But I think our questions are around this idea of, you know, how do we do a better job of watching for when the environment has changed around a structure in ways that make the change the design criteria of the structure. Is that a fair summary? Right.
You've just described the value of a digital twin.
That's an interesting one. So are you suggesting that people would take digital twins of, you are suggesting that you would take a digital twin of something that you might have already have as an artifact or don't have the same control over, but because you have a twin of it, you can now start doing simulations.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're doing with bridges and train trestle bridges all over Europe. IBM is big in that. There's a lot of companies that are involved in them. And digital twins have evolved in the last 2 years to start to bridge the gaps between different operations. That's really been the challenge, is you can take one process end to end, that's part of a sub-process, let's say, and do a digital twin on it and get all the real-time data back from the sensors and actuators and other devices that may be part and parcel of a system. But then how do you link it to the next process, which may have completely different data sets, data types, ontologies, taxonomies, whatever, whatever. Having those two things come together and be ruled by like physics-driven engines or geospatial, that's how they're starting to put things together. But there's a bunch of videos from IBM on what they've done with digital twins on train tracks and trestle bridges and other kinds of pipelines. Boston Dynamics has them also from Spot as it's investigating subway tunnels for maintenance. So they use them for concrete evaluation where cracks are forming, color changes, temperature changes, anything that you can think of that you could put into a data stream, you can pretty much use in a digital twin.
Okay.
And this is the value of them.
It's
a pity Boeing's not using them better or more for quality control.
Do you see, oh boy, it's easier to run the scenarios. I mean, are we still back in this situation is even if you have the digital twins, you still have to be smart enough to run the scenarios and do that work? I guess there's no substitute for analysis.
Well,
it's faster and easier.
Well, it depends on what kind of tools you're using. I mean, you could actually configure, believe it or not, generative AI to do most of the asking for you or to give you the right prompts to use. But there's companies, like I spoke to one yesterday the day before yesterday, that was really, really interesting, that has taken the idea of PubSub and MQTT and then redone it in a way using a modeling architecture from the 60s that was introduced, where you can do one-to-many kind of data streaming in real time and involve streaming from third-party sources. And so you could take like ROS, ROS2, DDS, MQTT, and other streams, aggregate them all and do the ETL in transit in a secure way. So I can send all of you a message as a one-to-many broadcast, put it in Rich's favorite choice for encryption, your favorite choice for encryption, you know, Tim's as well, Klaus's as well, and even do the translation from, you know, one lingua franca to another at the same time. It's a very valuable technology. And there's a whole open source and Eclipse project geared to this. This is the kind of stuff that will be the next iteration of twins.
And at the end of the day, though, when you think about the digital twins, you have to be able to programmatically create an environment where you can manage the variables. When you start adding too many variables, as you start adding variables, it gets exponentially more complicated very quickly. And so you get to a point where you can't just... I can't think of a really good example off the top of my head. Sorry, my head was in a different space prior to this call. A bunch of CIOs and executives and board members talking about the future. So how do you take an environment and say, okay, I want to drop a piece of technology into an environment and all the different potential variables that that come with it? From human components to physical components to other components. I mean, you get to a point where it's really complicated, and maybe theoretically we could do that. We could programmatically create that environment, but the amount of horsepower and the amount of compute that would be required to do that would be just off the charts. And then you have to clearly understand how each of those different variables relate to one another. And I think eventually we will get there where you could say, hey, I'm going to pull a weather package off the shelf and just apply it. Or I'm going to pull this off the shelf and just apply it.
Oh.
But today,
that you look at physics-driven AI that's used in manufacturing because it's been there for 5 years.
Cool.
This is trade-off management and expert systems that are used by Boeing, Mercedes, all the major automakers, all the major aerospace and defense manufacturers. And they've been around for a long time because GIS has been around for a long time. And that multivariate analysis, I did part of my thesis on that. In terms of the multivariate analysis, you can now use algorithmic programming that is the physics engines that are behind not only digital twins, but much of the AI that's used in manufacturing. So I agree with you that it's complex. And this is the earlier point I made about linking digital twins across different processes. That's where you start to be able to aggregate your results and get to what I wouldn't call a fully expert system, but one that you can manage, because like a small language model, you pare it down to what's real, and then based on that, you go forward.
Is this almost like having a multiplayer video game from that perspective,
yeah,
where all the different components in your space are
basically, yes, yeah. And it's exactly that. And you, and for the same reasons that multiplayer games have to take into account data communication latencies,
right? You
know,
if I have a couple of players almost co-located with the servers, and somebody else on the other side of the world, what do you do?
Exactly.
And so you have to play a lot of those games.
So
these are essentially ways of federating systems, and then along with the federation, and to address the issues that Tim was just discussing, one of your chief jobs here is reducing dimensionality. It's, you know, anything I can do to simplify the machine learning aspects on each of these processes, anything I can do that will take out dimensionality, reduce, sometimes it's a matter of reducing the granularity. It's like quantizing in mm-hmm. some ways.
Yeah.
You know, it turns out that you can move from 16-bit floating point to 4, and you'll still have the necessary accuracy. You'll get better latency. You'll get, you know, lots of different things. It's a matter of kind of, It's still a black art, though, to do it. It's not enough of a science. It's still a craft.
Well, would you say the same thing about Vehicle to Anywhere? Sure. V2X?
Vehicle Absolutely. To Anywhere?
Yeah.
Yeah, V2X is a domain that's rising very, very fast, because you mm-hmm. have companies like the one that I mentioned that I was speaking to the other day, where the whole reason they exist is because the two founders realized that they were going to have that level of and degree of complexity to do V2X. And you need that for all the telemetry. I mean, think about what Swift was doing, right? I mean, all the telemetry for a vehicle, from the vehicle to the vehicle, what's around the vehicle, the LIDARs, all the various technologies included. That's a burgeoning area, but it's one that's very similar to what's existed for a little while in digital twins and previously in expert systems that were GIS based.
Yeah.
So it's not fundamentally new technology. It's just the architectures of it. And what's really interesting is in the situation that I was describing of this new client, their whole thing is cloud to thing and thing to cloud, which means that they incorporate virtually every touch point from the thing to an edge, to a data center, to a cloud, to a hybrid cloud, to a multi-cloud, to, you know, call it highly distributed or parallel architecture, or call it federated. You know, either way, it's going to have to do the same thing. And every autonomous vehicle is going to have that capability around it.
Yeah, I just scratched the surface of it in some work I was doing with Qualcomm several years ago. And it's just absolutely mm-hmm. fascinating. I mean, moving from V to V to V to X. And Rob, if you're not as... Yeah.
I'm not, this isn't an area I've been tracking. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating, because just imagine everything that you use as a human driving a vehicle. So you use your eyes in terms of weather conditions, road conditions. You got an accident coming from your navigation to reroute you. You've got stoplight data that has to be communicated. And then, of course, you have just just traffic data from the actual other vehicles on the road that get, that might be in different systems.
Right.
So, and that's just, I mean,
so, but are we talking here about the car's sensor array then sharing that data?
No,
or is it data coming in from out other sensors to the car?
It's both. It's the car sharing the data elements it has access to. And then it's also the different various data sources beyond other vehicles that it's consuming.
This has always been a vision to me to have, you know, vehicles be part of the network that they're driving in and sharing data. But my understanding was the protocols were so...
they're a mess.
Yeah.
They're a bloody mess. They, you know, no one has done a good job with them. They, the handoffs alone are just, you know, nightmarish. So, yeah, you know, number of startup companies have broken their pick on exactly that issue.
This issue, yeah. And the one, it's interesting because there's a privacy component in this. I don't know if y'all saw the lawsuits with GM sending driver profile data to LexisNexis.
Nexis.
Nexis. Yeah. And so without consent.
Well, remember.
Other manufacturers do that too.
Without clear consent.
Well, you remember we had the conversation about if I'm in the car and it's autonomous and I have other people with me and we have a conversation, we have an expectation of having privacy in that vehicle. How do we regulate that? How do you keep the car from picking up and recording your conversations and then using that information? Who does that data belong to? Is it the owner of the vehicle? Let's say it's an Uber, for example. Is it the owner of the vehicle? Is it the owner of record or the OEM of the system? How do you ensure privacy in that situation? And there's an ongoing suit with Arrival, which makes the buses that are autonomous that are coming out all over the place in Europe. And I'm not sure that Waymo isn't part of that whole thing as well. But this is the reason. And just so you guys know, around Windsor, just across from Detroit, there's an entire community of geekdom that has been working on not only the V2X problems, but the security and the cybersecurity of V2X. And there's probably 100 different companies that are involved in that whole sector on our side of the border and Lake on the other side as well. But it's a joint venture.
And Europe as well. Like Bosch is a,
yeah,
that they have a big foot in that.
Does that turn some of this into the car manufacturer's dream of creating subscriptions for the turning from buying the asset to buying a car subscription?
Yeah.
Well, you don't buy product. You buy experience.
Okay. I mean, it makes sense for autonomous cars if you're not buying the car, but what we keep getting closer and closer to the, you know, you can't buy a sensor network and there's so much service and service component involved.
No, you're a subscriber.
You're a subscriber. Yeah.
I mean, there was a little bit of blowback to, who was it, BMW, that was thinking about doing it with access to heated seats or something crazy like that. But I do think that we'll see it show up in other ways first that are a little more innocuous, meaning you have access to satellite radio, kind of the Sirius, you know, kind of model, right? You already have access to it. You just have to sign up for it. And just imagine if you take that further into like insurance. So based on my driving, maybe that has an impact to my insurance rate.
Definitely exist, yeah.
No, but I'm saying as a standard, right? No. Standard in the vehicle, right? Where this isn't something that you add on. I know you can add on today, but just imagine if it's a standard in the vehicle where you can pay for subscriptions.
The challenge becomes what happened with the the driver who's suing GM, right? And I know it's other vehicles too, but their insurance rates went up. They got basically locked out insurance, which is mandated as a requirement because of their driving patterns. And there's no, one of the things that bugs me about it is there's no way for you to protest or you know, complain, right? If you're flagged for aggressive braking, it's might have, you know, might be the, you know, environment you're driving in. You might have just avoided an accident.
It's a private company. There's no Freedom of Information Access request.
I actually just requested my credit report to see if it's on there. But yeah,
I was going
to
say it's not unlike the credit reporting systems that for, you know, it's taken, you know, and several acts of Congress and high explosive to get even any access to and means by which, you know, the credit bureaus will allow you to see what you've got and then make any changes. And even then, what they show you is actually not what they turn over to their corporate customers.
This is insane.
And it's such it's so frustrating because what they produce to you, like if you pay to have access to Experian, what they show you is not what gets shown to, like you said, to the creditors that you might be applying for a loan for a car, for a house or something else. There are a myriad of different scores
Exactly. You go to FICO and the number of different, to your point, the number of different scores and they're packaged by industry. So, you know,
so
you're selling it to insurance, if you're selling it to insurance, if you're selling it to banks, different packages altogether.
Yeah. So, you know, just as an aside, I invested in FICO many years ago.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
It's crazy. That stock has just skyrocketed in the last 5 to 8 years. I mean, most solid performers have, but that's one that just, it was kind of surprising how high it's
crazy. I think it's funny because in some ways we jump from digital twins in manufacturing to functionally, these are digital twins of people. It's your FICO score.
Hmm? But I think that's about to change.
Okay.
Because the regulatory requirements around AI will change it. Because there's a big pushback on, it's not what personal PII that you collect, it's how it's being used against you. And if you look at big systems like the way they revamped, how do I put it? In the US, you have notaries. We have notaries here too. But when you buy a house or do a loan or a mortgage or anything like that, you now have to verify and validate your identity. And it's being done by AI in a way that makes you provide personal information to verify your identity, but then doesn't retract it once your identity is being verified. And if you look at the really picky in details of the European Union's AI policy, there are bits and pieces of the same thing happening, and that's going to cause a major backlash. So while it's coming out of the AI stream, and it would affect every kind of signatory and legal document and all this kind of stuff, there's a huge push. Like, for example, I had to, you know, renew my mortgage and they asked me to validate my identity because I was doing it remotely. So I sent my passport and a bunch of other documents. And then they said, well, we use services now to verify the identity as opposed to doing it with human resources. And I said, no. Why? Because one of the services wanted access to the NFC on my phone. And I said, not happening in my lifetime, guys. Sorry. If I have to get in my car and drive down there, I'll send you a bill for the time. And they said, well, no, because it's a fair distance from where I am. You know, we're talking about a 3-hour drive there and back. That being said, they said, well, we have to scan your passport using the NFC code. And I said, no, you don't. And by law, I can prove that the privacy commissioners say the only organization allowed to do that are government bodies, not private enterprise.
Right.
So I think you're going to see a lot of discourse around these kind of capabilities, because what is considered personal information can also be your mobility. How hard do you hit that gas pedal or that brake? And there's no sensor in it other than a mechanical device that shows it being depressed or being released. What about the touch of your foot?
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of that claim that you're talking about.
Well,
he wants, that's what he's arguing for, is if you're going to do that, you should have sensor data.
Oh,
he's
saying they should be telling more data.
No,
they should have baseline.
Okay. They have baselines. And by the way, your smartphones with their gyroscopic capabilities have all kinds of you can get all kinds of data off of, you know, how aggressive you are in your turning.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention, mm-hmm. you know, braking, acceleration, everything else. And we were looking at that 12 years ago and just, you know, getting very scared.
I have no doubt.
On that note, I need to end on time today, so I'm going to wrap this up. Right. I appreciate this. This is fun because we went from the bridge through some really interesting engineering and analysis all the way through the others. I pushed back the topic, the plan topic, just to the 18th, so a month. And then I'm going to look at schedules for the book, and we'll put a book club reading. It's supposed to be for the summer, so we'll look at May probably as a target date.
Cool.
All right, everybody. Tim, thank you for coming in.
See you all.
See you. Ciao.
Bye all.
Bye.
Have a good one.
Well, one of the things I love about this group is our willingness to pick up, you know, a really deep event like this and then take it in a place where we can really extract some learnings, even though it's very early, even though none of us are civil engineers. I think that there are a lot of lessons to be learned about intersections of technologies and systems in looking at this event. It's going to be fascinating to watch the, you know, as a Baltimore native, watch the recovery and the analysis of what went on here, but even more deeply, what types of lessons we learn from this failure and how we apply it going forward. I hope this is helpful and you are enjoying. If you're listening now, you're probably enjoying the Cloud 2030 podcast. Thank you. And please consider joining us. Come in, be part of the discussion. We love to dissect items. And if you're still hearing me talk, then you enjoy that type of thing too. And we would love to have you with us. You can find out our whole schedule and more at the2030.cloud. I'll see you there. Thank you for listening to the Cloud 2030 podcast. It is sponsored by RackN, where we are really working to build a community of people who are using and thinking about infrastructure differently. Because that's what RackN does. We write software that helps put operators back in control of distributed infrastructure, really thinking about how things should be run and building software that makes that possible. If this is interesting to you, please try out the software. We would love to get your opinion and hear how you think this could transform infrastructure more broadly. Or just keep enjoying the podcast and coming to the discussions and, you know, laying out your thoughts and how you see the future unfolding, all part of building a better infrastructure operations community. Thank you.